From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. President Bush will soon decide whether the government will fund embryonic stem cell research. The issue is at the center of political and medical controversy and has even divided the president's party. The research could help reverse Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's, and spinal cord injuries. But opponents say that destroying embryos is destroying human life. On today's Fresh Air, bioethicist Art Kaplan explains the science of stem cell research and the medical and political controversies surrounding it. Kaplan directs the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new edition of the Grove Dictionary of Music and Musicians. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stasio. The FBI says some laptop computers and guns are missing from the Bureau's inventory. An FBI official says one and possibly more computers have classified information. NPR's Barbara Bradley reports.
An FBI official says one computer from an FBI field office contains classified information on two investigations. Both of the cases are closed. Three other laptops that are unaccounted for may have classified information. The FBI is trying to determine if that's the case, and if so, whether the information pertains to open or closed investigations. In total, the FBI says that 184 laptop computers are missing or stolen. The FBI had some embarrassing news about guns as well. 449 guns have been stolen or lost in the past 11 years. Most are sidearms, but some submachine guns are unaccounted for. The official says some of the stolen guns have since shown up at crime scenes. The Attorney General has asked the Inspector General to conduct a complete review. Barbara Bradley, NPR News, Washington.
The House today took another run at protecting Old Glory. For the fourth time in 6 years, the House approved a constitutional amendment banning desecration of the flag. The vote 298 to 125, but the measure is likely once again to be defeated in the Senate by lawmakers who say saving free speech rights is more important than saving the flag from desecration. The Supreme Court ruled in 1989 and again in 90 that flag burning and other acts of desecration were protected under First Amendment free speech rights. The Internal Revenue Service has accidentally sent incorrect tax return notices to hundreds of thousands of filers. The notices said those people would get the full amount possible for their tax return, when in fact they will not. NPR's Andrea Seabrook reports.
The IRS says it was human error and a faulty computer program that caused the wrong numbers. The notices went out this week to people who will receive their checks in the next several days. But instead of qualifying for the full refund, as the notice says, they'll get less. IRS spokesman Don Roberts says very few people will be affected by the mistake.
About 523,000 out of more than 112 million. It's less than 0.5% that are affected.
The IRS is rushing to fix the problem and get new notices out by next week. But it's still likely that some people will be disappointed by their checks before they get the corrected notice. Roberts suggests people figure out for themselves what the amount should be and expect that. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, Washington.
Some better-than-expected earnings reports have put investors in a buying mood, and that sent stocks higher at the close. Blue chips gained ground as heavy equipment company Caterpillar posted earnings that were weak but better than analysts expected. And Apple Computer reports third-quarter profits that beat Wall Street's expectations by 2 cents. Shares of Apple closed up $1.14, or nearly 5%, to $25.10 a share. The Dow is up 134 and the Nasdaq gained 38. You're listening to NPR News. Israeli helicopter gunships killed 4 Islamic militants in Bethlehem, triggering the first Palestinian mortar bomb attack on an Israeli target in the West Bank in some 10 months of bloodshed. NPR's Jennifer Ludden has details from Jerusalem.
The mortar shell landed in the yard of a building under construction, injuring no one. Israeli officials said it was a 60-millimeter and appeared to have been stolen from Israel's own army. Until now, dozens of mortar shells have been launched only from the Gaza Strip. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon vowed revenge for this latest attack. A coalition of Palestinian militant groups issued a statement vowing more attacks and calling for immediate revenge against every Israeli settler and soldier. The mortar strike came soon after Israeli helicopters fired missiles at a cinder block farmhouse near Bethlehem, killing the 4 militants. Israeli officials said they were planning an attack during next week's closing ceremonies of the Maccabi Games, known as the Jewish Olympics. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Leaders of Macedonia's main political parties today rejected a new Western peace proposal. The move dims hopes for a settlement between the Macedonian government and ethnic Albanian guerrillas. NATO Secretary General George Robertson and EU Foreign Policy Chief Javier Solana will fly to Skopje Thursday for a two-day attempt to revive the search for a political deal that would end 5 months of sporadic guerrilla warfare. Both crew members aboard an Air Force F-16 are dead after a crash in eastern California today. An Air Force spokesman says the plane crashed in a remote mountainous area. It was on a photo mission to record a test flight of another F-16. The plane had taken off from Edwards Air Force Base. I'm Frank Stachow, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo and its employees, working together in the Sodexo Stop Hunger program. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. President Bush is expected to decide this month whether the government will fund research using embryonic stem cells. The research, if successful, could help reverse Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, and spinal cord injuries. Opponents believe that destroying embryos to harvest the stem cells is killing human life. President Bush's party is divided over the issue. Opponents of abortion are divided. We invited medical ethicist Art Kaplan to explain stem cell research and its medical possibilities, and to discuss the questions he asks as a bioethicist when he's examining the ethical implications of such research. He joins us from time to time on Fresh Air to discuss medical issues. Kaplan is the director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, where he's also a professor of molecular and cellular engineering and professor of philosophy. In 1993, he became the first president of the American Association of Bioethics. Let's start with the basics. What are stem cells?
There's always been this understanding that one part of the embryo becomes the support system, umbilical cord, placenta, amniotic fluid, it's what supports the life of the embryo. And the other part of the embryo becomes the body, if you will, of the fetus and ultimately the baby and ultimately us. Somewhere inside that embryo, the cells have to differentiate. One part becomes support system, one part becomes, if you will, baby. It was 3 years ago now that scientists figured out what part of the embryo becomes the baby. That's the stem cell. So the stem cells are those cells that have the capability to turn into a fetus, a baby, a person, and to produce all kinds of cells, because obviously to make us, they have to be able to make skin cells, bone cells, lip cells, whatever.
And so when the stem cells are in the early embryonic stage, they're undifferentiated. They don't know yet whether they're going to be assigned to be lip cells or nose cells or kidney cells.
Exactly,
and they're capable
right.
of becoming any of those.
Anything. In fact, there's a kind of cute or technical word for this, they're totipotent. They can turn into anything that you want or need.
And how does that relate to medical research?
Well, if you looked at the human body and tried to figure out what diseases are caused by underlying cellular dysfunction, you'd see that some diseases, like Parkinsonism, are due to the fact that brain cells wear out and they're not making the chemicals they're supposed to anymore. If you could get a stem cell to put into an adult brain and rejuvenate that part of the brain, you could presumably reverse the symptoms of Parkinsonism. Similarly, in our bodies, the spinal cord, once it's damaged, it doesn't regrow. Embryo cells should be able to make those same spinal cord tissues and cause healing to take place in a paralyzed person. Less dramatic, but still very important. Sometimes children are born with islet cells that don't function. That's the part of the pancreas that makes insulin. So if you have juvenile diabetes, you can't make that chemical. If you could get embryo cells to turn into these islet cells and make the chemicals that are missing, you could transplant them just like we would a transplant into the body of a child and then have them make the missing insulin substance. So for a lot of the body's diseases, it's underlying damage to cells that don't regrow. And that's what stem cells really are targeted to fix.
How far are we along in the research? Is this just like speculation that stem cells could maybe reverse these diseases, or is there any evidence that they can?
Well, there's animal work that shows that it's possible to regenerate the spinal cord, and there's been some animal studies that have grown peripheral nerves of the sort you'd find in your hand or your foot that might get injured in a burn or in a traumatic injury. It's all animal work. If we're really going to be honest about this, the demonstration that you could take these stem cells, make a lot of them, put them into somebody's body and have them do what they're supposed to do, I'd say we're talking years, nothing like months.
Now, the debate right now has to do whether it is ethically correct to harvest stem cells from an embryo. What is the state of the embryo that we're talking about with stem cell research? Because I think a lot of people are confused about whether it's an embryo or a fetus and what the difference is between the two.
There really is a lot of confusion about what an embryo is. Every once in a while, I hear people debating this, and I think, no, you're confusing embryo research with fetal research. Embryos are potential or possible people. They are not yet fetuses. They haven't developed or differentiated at all. We're talking about taking cells from something that is 8 cells big or 16 cells big. So it's the size of a period at the end of a typewritten sentence, very teeny, undifferentiated thing. Now, there are different ways to get embryos. One is you can take sperm and egg from normal people, put them in a dish, and make embryos. So you could create them. Secondly, there are people who go around making embryos because they want to have babies. They do this in dishes at what we call in vitro fertilization clinics. So there are people paying a lot of money when they have fertility problems, and they're trying to make embryos because they want to have a baby. That process doesn't work very well. So there are often a lot of extra embryos made, and they'll be stored or frozen. So when we sometimes hear about embryos, what we're hearing about is frozen embryos, literally in a tank of nitrogen, liquid nitrogen, that is at 450 degrees minus 450, and there they sit, kind of in this frozen, suspended animation. Every once in a while at the infertility clinic, when you make an embryo, say you're a couple and you make 5 embryos, the doctor may look at those under the microscope right after they're created and say, one of these doesn't look good. We're not going to put that one in. But instead of destroying it or throwing it away, they may freeze that too. So there are embryos made in a dish, sperm and egg, just for the sake of creating them. That's what we heard about at the Howard Jones Institute in Virginia, where people were making embryos for research. Then there are embryos out there that are being made by couples who want to have babies, but sometimes they make too many. There are surplus embryos. Sometimes they make embryos that don't work right or don't look good. Those are, let's call them, damaged embryos. Both of those are around and frozen. An interesting and important fact about embryos. Under the best of circumstances, healthy people, no infertility problems, having sexual intercourse and making embryos kind of the birds and bees way, you probably get a pregnancy about 1 out of 4 times. In the best clinics, you probably get a pregnancy at an in vitro fertilization clinic maybe 1 out of 5 times. What that means is, even though people argue that an embryo is a person from the moment of conception, I think that's wrong. Most embryos are potential people, and some of them are not wired or programmed correctly, so they're not going to turn into anything ever.
So even in a woman's body, if her egg is fertilized and forms an embryo, only 1 out of 4 or 5 is actually going to make it into developing into a fetus. And
there's
the others
a tremendous loss mm-hmm. of embryos in the normal course of reproduction. Or another way to put it is people are having sex frequently enough that if they had a baby, every time they made an embryo, we'd be in an even more populated planet that we're in. A lot of them simply fall out of the woman's body and she never notices. There's a conception, but it doesn't implant. And even when it does implant, the spontaneous abortion rate is pretty high. So a lot of embryos just are not going to come to term. And that's why ethically I've never been comfortable saying that an embryo is a person or an embryo is alive from the moment it's conceived. A lot of them have chemical genetic problems that they're just not going to make people no matter what we did.
Now, could those that have problems still be used for stem cell research?
The one thing I began to realize when I looked at the biology of embryos was there's this large number of embryos that are damaged. There's a large number of embryos that have been frozen so long that no one is going to try and turn them into babies. They're simply too old. They still are valuable for research. So for some time now, I've thought the best candidates, the less morally contentious embryos, if you will, are the ones that are least likely to turn into people under any circumstance. So yes, you can use, for research purposes, a damaged embryo, or you could use one that had been frozen so long that no one would really want to try to use it to make a baby.
My guest is Art Kaplan. He directs the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. We'll talk more about stem cell research after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is bioethicist Art Kaplan, and we're talking about stem cell research. As a bioethicist, what questions do you ask yourself about whether it's ethically okay to use embryos for stem cell research? And let's look first at embryos that have been made at fertility clinics with the idea that a couple is trying to get pregnant or a woman is trying to get pregnant, and they've put these embryos, they've created these embryos and put them aside in the hopes that one of them will turn into a baby. Well, so the ones that are left over that would be discarded, how do you as a ethicist ask whether this is ethically okay?
I mean, I think the first thing I think about is what is the intention or motive behind the creation of the embryo? So let's presume your case, Terry. There's a couple. They want to have a baby. They're trying very hard to have a baby. They're very interested in life. They're very interested in becoming parents. They make a baby in good faith. Their motive is not to benefit research, to sell an embryo to somebody. It's simply to have their own child. It turns out that the technology is such that they're probably going to have to overproduce embryos in order to have any chance. And then some of the ones they make are simply going to be damaged. First, is the motive a good one? I think when you're at the IVF clinic, the motive is a good one. Let's say that's in contrast to the person who says, I think I'll go sell my eggs, I'll sell my sperm, I'll just get paid to make embryos. That motive seems to me less morally laudable. So why you create the embryos becomes important. And then what's the status of the thing you've created? If it really doesn't have the potential to become a person, or because it's been stored so long it's kind of lost its fertilizability, then while some people might want to argue all human embryos have to be treated as the same, I would say the moral status of the embryo begins to weaken in terms of showing respect to it or treating it as anything other than tissue once it begins to lose that capacity to become a baby or if it's damaged from the point of creation. So the two key factors are, why did we make it? And I think we do find ourselves in situations where people are making embryos for good reasons, but it turns out, sadly, they have more than they can use or that some of them are damaged. And then we get in situations where not all embryos are equal. And if we can figure out which ones, if you will, are unlikely to become people, that might be the set to go to for research.
So from your point of view, you're okay with the idea of using embryos that would otherwise be discarded that were made at fertilization clinics?
I am. And let me sort of reinforce that by saying, the embryos that are left behind at IVF clinics in this liquid nitrogen, once they get past 5 years of storage, I don't know any doctor who would say, well, let's try and use one of those embryos if you want to have a baby, as opposed to making a new one, because they start to lose their potency, not drastically. And it is true that an embryo that's been frozen 10, 15, or even 20 years could become a baby, but it's really losing some of its ability to do that. So I would say the spare or unwanted embryos that have lost their power somewhat to become babies, that's the category that I'm very comfortable in using for research.
Let's look at another category, and that is the category of a clinic that is creating embryos in vitro especially and only for the idea of harvesting the stem cells in these embryos. So these are embryos being created strictly for research. And there was one clinic that announced last week that that's what they're doing.
Right. The Howard Jones Institute in Virginia said, we're making embryos. And the suspicion is, by the way, that some other companies are doing this too. They just haven't talked about it. Private companies doing it with their own money, if you will.
Now, again, as a bioethicist, what questions do you ask to help you determine whether you think it's ethically okay to create embryos, especially for the idea of harvesting the stem cells?
Well, I'd ask the similar sorts of questions. I'd say, what's the motive? Mm-hmm. And then what's the status of the embryo that's been created? So let's look at the motive. If it's a private company, they may be making embryos for research, ultimately for profit. So the question is, should we create embryos to sell them, if you will, and then turn them to commercial gain? I think that that is somewhat disrespectful of human procreation or human reproduction. So I don't like the motive of saying I'm going to do this for money. The people who come and donate their sperm and eggs for specially creating embryos, they too are doing it because they want to get paid. So that adds an element of commercialization of business, if you will, to the creation of embryos. Less morally commendable than simply saying I'm trying to have a baby and unfortunately I've got these leftovers as a result, or I make some that don't work well. Then what kind of embryos are made? Well, when you're using sperm and egg from healthy people, not infertile people, the chances are greater that they're going to create normal embryos. So the odds of finding bad ones or keeping them a long time and then seeing them, as I said before, losing their potency, far less. It's much more likely you're going to have potential people if you specially create embryos than if you just use extra ones or the less desirable ones that pop up in the IVF setting. So I think if you compare the two, specially created embryos are morally more problematic because you're introducing commerce into the creation of human life. You're simply making things to destroy them, and you're probably destroying, if you will, healthier embryos.
So do you have a personal position on the creation of embryos for scientific research?
A long time ago, when I first realized that stem cell research was likely, I think 6 years ago now, I tried to write an article that said this is going to become a major controversy. The moral thing to do is first think about, do we need these embryos for research? And I think the answer to that is yes. While there are some people proposing other ways perhaps to do research on stem cells, the fact is to grow nerve tissue, to grow spinal cord tissue, to grow many types of tissue, embryo stem cells are going to be the best bet. It seems to me the people who are in wheelchairs, who are suffering from terrible brain diseases like Parkinsonism or Alzheimer's, have a moral claim on us. If we're going to then say that that claim is legitimate and we ought to try some research to help them, then it seems to me we ought to go to the embryos that are, if you will, the least ethically contentious. And to me, that's the spares and the leftovers and the damaged embryos. And I think if you really put this on the scales of justice and say, I've got an embryo in a freezer. It's been there 5 years. It will never be adopted. It will never be used. And in fact, no doctor in good conscience would try to have somebody make a baby with it because it's not going to work very well. And there's a person in a wheelchair saying, I'd like you to try some research that would help me get me out of this. The moral equation comes down heavily to use some of those embryos.
Now, there's another issue, and that is cloning. Another lab has announced that it has begun cloning embryos strictly for the purpose of research, stem cell research. What questions do you ask about cloning embryos for research?
Well, I'm glad that they announced that because they are doing everything they can to keep me in business. The more the more announcements they keep coming about, cloning embryos. Cloning embryos is a different trick entirely. Instead of making them from sperm and eggs, either kind of specially created by paid people giving their sperm and eggs or by leftover embryos from the IVF clinic, this company, and it is companies, Advanced Cell Technology has said, what we do is we take an egg. We core the DNA out of it, like an apple, just take that part right out, drop in DNA from another cell. It could come from your toe or your lip. And that is fused together and turns into an embryo-like thing. One reason that people are worried about this procedure of making stem cells this way is it's the first steps toward making human clones. And a lot of people have ethical difficulties with cloning humans. So they say, well, we don't want you to do anything like transfer DNA from your foot or your skin cells into an egg and then start this process. There'll be no stopping human cloning if we let any of this happen.
Well, the controversy right now is about harvesting stem cells from embryos after in vitro fertilization. But what about the question of in vitro fertilization? Have we really addressed that publicly yet?
One of the toughest issues that George Bush has not been asked to address is what's his position in general on in vitro fertilization. Remember, the place that I turn, and I think some people turn in hoping for a compromise, is to spare embryos or unwanted embryos. They are inherently something that's generated whenever somebody goes down to try a round of in vitro fertilization. They're just going to make more embryos than they're ever going to be able to use. Is Bush comfortable with this? Are those in the Republican Party who either for or against stem cell research, what do they think about this constant creation of spare embryos? And what do they propose to do with them? There are 100,000 of them right now in the United States. There may be 250,000 worldwide. The number keeps growing. And what's the status of these? We talk as if, well, they're just going to be destroyed. They're not going to just be destroyed. Their fate right now is in the hands of utility companies. As long as the electricity holds out, they stay frozen. No clinic wants to destroy them. They don't know what to do with them. And in the broader context of stem cell research, we keep making more and more embryos, more and more unwanted ones, some damaged ones. We should stop doing this. We should turn back the clock and not allow infertility treatment to go forward. It's one of the tough issues from a pro-life point of view. Is there anything more pro-life than infertile couples who want to have babies? I can't think of anything offhand. At the same time, they're making extra embryos all the time. What are we going to do with them?
Art Kaplan directs the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Nonesuch Records, now featuring Joko, the current album by Senegalese world music artist Youssou N'Dour. Available at all Barnes & Noble music locations. And from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Grant by Max Bird, a novel of the life of Ulysses S. Grant. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with bioethicist Art Kaplan about the controversy surrounding embryonic stem cell research. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new edition of the Grove Dictionary of Music and Musicians. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with bioethicist Art Kaplan. We're talking about embryonic stem cell research, the science behind it, and the controversy surrounding it. Kaplan directs the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, where he's also a professor of cellular engineering and a professor of philosophy. Now, how does the debate over stem cell research, over embryonic stem cell research, relate to the abortion debate? In the sense that in abortion, we're talking about a fetus that is in a uterus in a woman's body. And in the embryonic stem cell debate, we're talking about embryos that are in a Petri dish in a laboratory.
Well, I have a view about this. It's probably one that not everyone will agree with, but it seems to me embryos in a dish, for that matter, embryos that are fertilized inside a fallopian tube before they've implanted anywhere, before they've gotten into a uterus, before they've gotten into an environment in which they can grow, they are the blueprints of life, but they are not people. They're not the same as a fetus, a baby, or an adult. They are possible people because they have the genetic instructions, but until they get into an environment, a uterus normally, a womb, where they can implant and grow, then it's just a set of blueprints, and that's what the embryo is. Once you've got an implanted embryo, then you do have an entity that in theory is down the road toward personhood. So I would say a fetus is more than a possible person. It's now moved over to a potential person. So the way I would think about embryos is they're possible. Put them in the right place, could become something. Once they implant and become fetuses, they're potential babies.
Now, I think both sides of the abortion debate have a vested interest in the embryo stem cell research debate, and both sides feel that if the embryo debate goes in their direction, that they'll be ahead of the game, and if it goes against them, that they're in this kind of losing battle and they'll be falling behind. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
There's a cynical side of me that says the whole argument over stem cells is a diversion so that we don't have to go back to the abortion debate, and here's why. Let's say what we're talking about now is should the president and Congress allow federal funds to be used to do embryo research. And, I mean, the amount of discussion and agonizing that's gone on about this is probably unmeasurable. If I know my stem cell research, there are probably 20 scientists in the United States right now who could submit grants to do embryo research. And if listeners understand the NIH process, let's say 20 people said, I want money. They'd probably award 10 grants. That is, you'd have to compete, and they wouldn't give money to everybody. They'd give it to the 10 strongest researchers. If they did that, let's assume that next year every one of those researchers used 5 embryos to start off cell lines. The whole fight, in one sense, is a battle over the fate of 50 embryos. Now, if you think embryos are people, that's the fate over 50 lives, but most people don't subscribe to that view. I don't. The only way to understand the level of this debate is that it's a stalking horse or a surrogate for the abortion controversy. Because if we really went on the rounds and said, look, there are 50 frozen embryos out of 100,000 frozen embryos. We want to take 50 of them and do a year's worth of research. I don't know that this debate merits the kind of attention it's getting. But if you flip it around the way you presented it and said, the real question here is abortion. If we concede that embryos are not people, then we're going to lose the abortion fight. If we concede that they are people, but still there's choices to be made about how to put them in research, then we keep the pro-choice side alive. Abortion politics drives the whole debate.
Now, as a medical ethicist, do you think that the decision we make about embryonic stem cell research, do you think it should necessarily affect the abortion debate, or do you see those two issues as being separate?
I see them as completely separate. I'm a little sad that we don't make some nuanced distinctions in this debate, but if you're going to allow abortion, it's normally because you might say something like a woman should not be forced to have to bring to term a child in her body that she does not want. So part of the question becomes, can you force compel women to do something with their bodies? In that sense, there's a question about abortion of a woman's right to control her body, whether it's a person in there or someone else. If she doesn't want to house it, then she may have the right to remove it. Embryo research is about embryos that are outside the body. They're hanging around in public places, petri dishes, tanks of nitrogen. There's no one's body that has to be invaded, forced to do anything. So at its heart, the abortion debate forces a confrontation between the interests of a fetus that has already started down the path toward development and the right of a woman to say, well, I'm sorry, but I don't have to put my body to the nourishment or housing of this person that, I choose not to house. The embryo debate is about possible people, that is, genetic blueprints that are in dishes or tanks for the most part, and who's going to control them. And I don't think the one really has much to do with the other.
This is a big debate now, I think, particularly in the Republican Party, because both sides of the party, the side that's for abortion and against abortion, the side that's for the research and against the stem cell research, are battling for George Bush's attention. And they each want President Bush to go the way that they want. And he hasn't decided yet, but he's supposed to decide. It's said he will decide sometime later this month. What's it like for a medical ethicist like you to watch a medical ethical debate be in the hands of political people at least as much as it is in the hands of medical people?
It can be bothersome because one thing that happens is because it's such a core political debate, if you will, over the soul of the Republican Party, we've got the social conservatives squared off against, to some extent, the libertarian part of the party. I've seen people like Bill Safire, Orrin Hatch, Connie Mack, Strom Thurmond saying, well, there's really benefit here. I don't see embryos the same way. And others in the conservative, social conservative part of the Christian right saying they're people from the point of conception. They escalate the rhetoric. So one side is yelling baby killer and the other side is kind of yelling benefits that can be obtained. The moral nuances about where embryos come from, understanding why stem cell research isn't the same as the abortion debate because the issue of women's bodies, women's rights, privacy, that gets lost. You tend to see an escalation in rhetoric that is pure politics.
Now, one way opponents of embryo research have tried to get around the issue is to say, well, let's use adult stem cell tissues that would come from what instead of embryos?
Yet another confusing twist here. Scientists, being scientists, refer to stem cells as anything that can make another kind of cell. So there are stem cells in our bodies right now that don't come from embryos. Your skin is constantly being replaced. Somewhere in the inside of our skin layers, there are cells making new skin cells. They are skin stem cells. As many of us will remember from high school biology, our blood system is constantly being replaced in our bodies. The place where those stem cells live is in our bone marrow. There are bone marrow stem cells that make blood. It is true that adult stem cell research on cells like bone marrow could come up with many useful things for people. But we also know that there are parts of the body, most particularly the nervous system, that doesn't grow. It doesn't appear to have any kind of once it's set in, it's sort of finished, and it doesn't have the capacity to regrow or regenerate. Embryo stem cells, I suspect, are the only hope for treating those kinds of diseases. If I was trying to argue the ethics here, I'd say, let's do some moderate amount of research on embryo stem cells. Let's do some aggressive amount of research on adult stem cells, but you're not going to really replace completely embryo stem cell research by adult stem cell research, because that just makes already specialized cells.
My guest is Art Kaplan. He directs the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. We'll talk more about stem cell research after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're discussing embryonic stem cell research with Art Kaplan, director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but the decision President Bush has to make is whether he will allow federal funding for embryonic stem cell research. He's not deciding whether it should be legal or illegal, but rather should it be funded with taxpayer dollars.
lost in all the screaming is the fact that whatever President Bush decides, private companies and private clinics that use their own money or investors' money in other countries are going to do stem cell research. Embryo stem cell research is going to proceed. Britain has already made it legal. There's already embryo stem cell research going on in Sweden. The clinic in Virginia that made the specially created stem cells did so with its own money, and there are at least two companies out there that I suspect are making human embryos to study them with pure private money. The debate, more accurately, should be, will stem cell research go on quickly or slowly, and will it go on with oversight, or is it simply going to be left to the marketplace to determine what happens? If it's done by a company using their money, well, the fact is they will keep it as a trade secret. No one will know what they're doing. And in all likelihood, they're probably going to patent or license their discoveries. It's going to cost a lot more money to get the benefits of privately sponsored stem cell research than it would be to have publicly funded stem cell research.
What are some of the other differences between publicly funded research and private research? Do you think that the government would have more oversight if there were more publicly funded research? Are there...
I guess I'd say flat out.
What are some of the controls that the government might put into effect for research involving public funding?
If the government were to come in and say, regretfully, sadly, some types of research can only proceed using embryos, we want to restrict what kinds of embryos are used. So we would like to keep it to spare embryos or damaged embryos, if you will. We don't want to see anybody going out and making embryos commercially. We don't want anybody paid to go out and make embryos. They could put those restrictions over what's taking place. They could also say, look, we don't want redundant research. Let's try to use the fewest number of embryos in doing embryo research. If companies are doing it, they'll compete against one another, and they may do the exact same research using many more embryos because they're not going to tell each other what they're doing, whereas if it's a federally sponsored study, it's public, it's out there, you're not going to have redundancy. If you want the fewest number of embryos used and you want to restrict where they come from, probably to, let's say, spare embryos left behind at clinics, you should favor government-sponsored embryo research.
Is there any chance that the government will outlaw this kind of research or put restrictions on it, even if there isn't federal funding?
If I was going to guess, I'd say we will either see Congress and the president do nothing, in which case there won't be federal funds de facto. They just won't put any money forward for it, and it will be in the private sector, and it will be driven by the marketplace. Or we'll get a compromise that says we'll fund a limited number of studies using only spare embryos. We're going to go slowly down that road. I think they might have gotten that compromise. The announcement by this clinic in Virginia that they were specially creating embryos kind of put the whole movement toward a compromise into a tizzy. As somebody who's argued for many years now that the spare embryos are the place to go, I was bitterly disappointed to see what I thought was an emerging consensus on a very contentious ethical question devastated by this, shall we say, untimely announcement that this clinic was just going to go out and do what it wanted to do. On the other hand, if you're going to stop that clinic, I don't think they're going to ban research in the United States. It's almost unconstitutional to tell somebody in science you can't pursue a line of inquiry with your own money. So I don't think we'll see that banned. Ironically, the best way to control what the clinic in Virginia is doing is by having a federal restriction on what federal funds can do, and then you shame or guilt the private sector into coming along with your rules. You kind of use that as the model, and then anyone who's not doing that, you're kind of, if you will, guilting them and saying you should be doing this too.
Now, what was the Clinton administration policy on stem cell research? Because they were in the middle, too, on this issue.
They had a very funny policy. This was the don't ask, don't tell policy of embryos. What they wound up saying was, look, we want to fund stem cell research, but we don't want to know where the stem cells come from. So if you get them by specially creating them or you make an arrangement with an infertility clinic to send you spare embryos, don't talk about it. We won't ask where they came from. Once you've got the stem cells, we'd like to fund that. So they had this kind of almost Wernher von Braun kind of thing. You know, I build missiles, but where they fall, I don't know. Their policy was where they come from, these embryos, we don't know. Where you got your stem cells, we're not going to ask. But once you've got them, then you could use federal funds to do research on them.
So in other words, they wouldn't fund any of the development of the embryos or the harvesting of the cells.
Correct.
But once the cells were harvested,
then
that research would be funded.
Correct. And I have to say, that met with a unanimous chorus of skepticism. I mean, nobody was buying that.
The president is scheduled to meet later this month with the Pope, and it's assumed that one of the issues they will talk about is stem cell research. What has the Pope's stand on this been?
The hierarchy of the Catholic Church has said absolutely no to stem cell research. It sees life beginning at conception. It basically does not draw the distinction that I've drawn between damaged embryos or embryos losing potency. All embryos are to be treated with reverence and cannot be destroyed for even noble purposes like battling disease. And the church has gone further. Remember, it doesn't like in vitro fertilization. While it doesn't consider it a major sin, it still finds the creation of life by non-sexual means morally troubling. So the Pope has said he's not comfortable with in vitro fertilization, with artificial reproductive technologies. He's not anything that separates baby making from sexual activity is not acceptable. And the results of that absolutely cannot be used for research, can't be destroyed in any way.
Do you think that our medical technology is moving at a quicker rate than our ethical decision making is and our ethical comprehension?
You know, I don't.
Our policies, is, I guess.
I'll tell you why
ethical policies.
I don't.
Yeah.
I think the ethicists, even ones that I disagree with and therefore we could define as wrong, but but even when you do battles in bioethics, I think the ethicists have been pretty good about anticipating cloning, artificial hearts, stem cell research. Where we fall behind is in our political ability to grapple with these technologies. I can show you a mountain of literature that would say, ooh, cloning is going to happen. We better get ready for that. But politicians in general, particularly around reproductive matters, anything that gets near the abortion debate, they really don't want to go there. And so we don't have the political will in a divided society to try and find forums or avenues for reaching consensus. Politically, let's face it, President Bush is in a terrible position. Whatever he decides, he's irritated either half of his own party or a large number of the American people. If he had his choice, I think he'd prefer not to be talking about stem cells at all.
And you think that's the way a lot of politicians are? With new medical technology, it's easier to just not deal with it.
You look at do we want to use animals for transplant? You see people trying to wrestle with questions of do we want to clone human beings? Generally speaking, from a political point of view, these are terrible issues because they're highly divisive and you wind up alienating half your base. So I think the political response often is ostrich-like, just head in the ground, forget it, we don't want to talk about it. What that does in the American context, and it kind of puzzles the rest of the world, is that it leaves all of our technology moving solely by business ethics. It's the marketplace. If you looked at, just to give an example, we have almost no laws and regulations involving reproductive technology in general. We see people selling their eggs on the internet, the infamous co-ed eggs, Ivy League eggs, where people are selling them. We see people involved in surrogate arrangements where they sell their wombs. We see clinics making 7 and 8 babies with no restriction on the number of embryos they can transfer. There's no regulation. There's no control. I should add, we often see couples battling about who owns the embryos when they divorce or get in a situation where somebody has died and somebody wants to make a claim. No rules, no regulations. The only thing that is operative is basically who's paying. The rest of the world kind of is startled at the fact that we're the leading biomedical and technological innovators. We have more of this going on than anywhere. We have the least regulation, the least political input, the least oversight. It's basically just, can you pay me? Then you'll get it done.
Well, Art Kaplan, I want to thank you so much for talking
with us. My pleasure.
Art Kaplan directs the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania.
Thank you.
Coming up, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new edition of the Grove Dictionary of Music and Musicians. This is Fresh Air. For more than a century, the Grove Dictionary of Music and Musicians, first edited in 1878 by Sir George Grove, has been the most extensive classical music reference work in English. It's gone through six editions, and this year an updated new 29-volume set was published. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz frequently turns to Grove's dictionary for all kinds of information.
On top of the filing cabinet next to my desk, I still have my copy of the 10-volume paperback reprint of Grove's Musical Dictionary that I got in 1973. I still love dipping into it, though it was already 20 years out of date by the time I bought it. There were great articles, some of them practically small books, some of them extremely well written. And there were those amazing lists of composers' complete works, sometimes pages and pages. But the history of music is constantly changing. There's new scholarship, new music, new composers, even new subjects. The so-called New Grove's Dictionary appeared in 1980, doubled to 20 volumes. Now there's a major new edition of the New Grove. In 28 huge volumes, plus an entire separate volume for the index. If Grove's has been the Encyclopedia Britannica of classical music, this new edition even looks like the Encyclopedia Britannica. There are, of course, timely new social and political entries on the Americas, feminism, gay and lesbian music, undreamed of for an encyclopedia two decades ago. Grove's used to concentrate on classical music, but now there are new or expanded sections on jazz, rock, and ethnic music. 29,500 entries in all, by 6,000 different writers. 900 new articles on contemporary composers alone. It's overwhelming. Very few readers will ever get through all of it. Pianist Charles Rosen, who is one of the rare people qualified to evaluate the entire set, has a complicated review in the New York Review of Books, admiring some of the results, yet lamenting others. He both regrets cutting the old article on Wagner's music, for example, while praising the new one. I'm not a musicologist, which is one of the reasons I need the New Grove, but I know it doesn't always have all the information I want. I recently looked up a Verdi opera for a review I was writing, but I needed to go to Grove's Dictionary of Opera for more details. In a new article on songwriter Lawrence Hart, I discovered that his middle name was Milton, but there was no reference to the very last show he worked on, The Revival of a Connecticut Yankee, for which he added some of his most brilliant lyrics. How can this be a musical Bible if the word of God can't be entirely trusted? But this is an age of miraculous technology. The New Grove is also online, which is both cheaper to access if you or your library can't afford the $4,850 price tag, and you don't have to wait 20 years for corrections and new material to be added. The printed volumes may already be more obsolete than the online version. But I still relish opening a book, turning the pages, like browsing through the dictionary. So although I didn't find what I needed about Verdi's Macbeth, since I had volume 26 in hand, 12 note to Wagner tuba, I couldn't put it down. I found out about music from Uzbekistan, and that the movie theater organ was originally called the Unit Orchestra, that the original name for Van Halen was Mammoth, that an ancient Roman scholar and poet named Marcus Terentius Varro wrote an eloquent defense of music, and that there's a 19th century French dance I never heard of called the Varsovienne. I found a wonderful photograph of the legendary 19th century soprano Pauline Viardot. I looked at entries on gospel composer James Vaughan, Sarah Vaughan, Stevie Ray Vaughan, and Rafe Vaughan Williams, as well as articles on valves, vamping, varnish, vaudeville, vibrato, and the vibraphone. And I dipped into the 42-page, double-columned article about Variations, one of the pieces Charles Rosen singles out for high praise. I don't need most of this information, but it's mysteriously gratifying. I tell my students that learning is about discovery. Every now and then, I need to remind myself.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and director of the Creative Writing Program at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember Katharine Graham, the former publisher of The Washington Post. She's died at the age of 84. We'll listen back to a 1997 interview recorded after the publication of her Pulitzer Prize-winning memoir. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.